Attention MongoDB enthusiasts. We've got some exciting news for you. On June 22nd, 2023, MongoDB is bringing its world-renowned .local conference to New York City. This is an event you won't want to miss. At MongoDB.local New York City, you'll have the opportunity to learn about the latest updates and tools to build and deploy mission-critical applications at scale. Whether you're a seasoned developer or just getting started with MongoDB, there's something for everyone at this action-packed event. Get ready to experience an announcement-filled keynote, dive into technical sessions on application development, data modeling, security, and much more. Plus, you'll have the chance to network with like-minded professionals and MongoDB experts. Don't miss this incredible opportunity to boost your MongoDB knowledge and skills. Save the date, June 22nd, 2023, in the heart of the Big Apple, New York City. For more information and to secure your spot, head on over to mdb.link/2023 or check out the show notes of this episode. Be sure to use the code PODCAST50 for a 50% discount on your tickets. See you there.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kavli Taru from the GDELP Project, and welcome to the MongoDB podcast. Today, we're going to talk about the GDELP Project and about this broader issue of how do we transform all this incredible data that we have today to real-world insights that enable us to make actual decisions about the world.
This is the MongoDB podcast. As ever, you're very welcome. My name is Shane McAllister. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Kalev Lataru. Kalev was named one of Foreign Policy Magazine's top 100 global thinkers in 2013. He was a Yahoo Fellow in Residence of International Values, Communications, Technology, and the Global Internet at Georgetown University, as well as a council member of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on the Future of Government. His work has been profiled in the press and media of more than 100 nations. This work focuses on how innovative applications of the world's largest datasets, computing platforms, algorithms, and mindsets can reimagine the way we understand and interact with our global world. Kalev is the founder of the GDELP Project. GDELP stands for Global Database of Events, Language, and Tone, and the GDELP Project monitors the world's broadcast, print, and web news from nearly every corner of every country in over 100 languages, and identifies the people, locations, organizations, themes, sources, emotions, counts, quotes, images, and events driving our global society every second of every day, thus creating a free, open platform for computing on the entire world. The GDELP Project was also the subject of the MongoDB Hackathon, ran earlier this year from April to May in advance of the MongoDB World event in New York. During this hackathon, over 600 global registrants used the GDELP dataset along with MongoDB products such as Atlas, Search, Charts, Functions and Triggers to create innovative projects showcasing this enormous global data archive. Let's take a listen to our conversation with Kalev. Welcome to the MongoDB podcast. Today, my guest is Kalev Lataru, and Kalev is from GDELP. And GDELP needs a lot of explaining, I think. But Kalev, first of all, welcome to the show. It's delighted to have you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So we first met back in April of this year. MongoDB were building a hackathon around our MongoDB World event that we were running in June. And we chose this amazing large data set that we knew existed on the web. And we started to build our hackathon theme around that. And then after doing our first live stream on this hackathon event, Kalev got in touch with us. And I should have expected that, because somebody who monitors data on the web on a daily ongoing basis should obviously pick up mentions of their main project. So, Kalev, you know, for those that are not familiar, why don't you do, say, a proper introduction to yourself, but more so to the GDELP Project and the history behind that?
Yeah, so the GDELP Project is really this grand vision of how can we leverage massive computing power to try to understand planet Earth? So essentially, in real time, every day, we're scooping up news media from across the world. And one of our real unique focuses is trying to reach local news in local languages across every corner of the world. And this is really different. You know, you think about so much of the work on news analytics these days has been, you know, someone scraping a couple RSS feeds. In fact, when GDELT first really started entering the social sciences space, it was really interesting because there's this law, you know, there's in a lot of fields, there's kind of this idea, like literally sort of this quasi motto. If it's not in English in the New York Times, it didn't happen or it doesn't mean anything. Yes, it's not relevant to the world. And so that was a big thing of how do we really reach across the world? And that requires a very different mindset of working country by country with local organizations across the world to catalog the news, to find ways of ingesting that news. It requires a lot of interesting thought. One of the fascinating things about data analytics today is the fact that we really have these pipelines that are oftentimes very English-centric, that, you know, Unicode is still scary, you know, frighteningly enough, still a foreign concept to a lot of pipelines. So there's so much technical work. But then I think one of the things that's most relevant to today's episode is this question of, well, you know, as you reach across the world, how do you derive meaning from that? You know, how do you reach across the world's languages? And then once you start creating this fire hose of global events, like, what do you do with that? And so if you kind of think of it, you know, if we kind of step back a little bit, GDELT's really this idea of this fire hose of news media pouring in. We monitor 150 languages today, soon to be over 400 languages. We translate 65 of those in real time. So essentially, this fire hose of news coming in from across the world, entering in, and that's online news. Now, in collaboration with the Internet Archive, we're also working with them on unlocking television news. So they have an archive of over 98 channels that spans 50 countries and territories, over 35 languages and dialects, portions of which stretch back more than 20 years.
You have 20 years. Like, when did it start? How did it come about, Kalev? Like,
yeah, so the GDELT project really traces its lineage. Over a quarter century ago, I was actually in eighth grade building web authoring software, the early days of the web, started doing large-scale web crawling, large-scale web mining, sort of a tiny sort of GDELT in this tiny, tiny early nascent stage. And trying to see, like, what would it look like if you could crawl, again, back then from a home computer, if you could sort of crawl news in the web, bring that in, run data mining on it. Then I was an undergrad actually at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, and then a grad student there. And then using really, really big machines to really pull in. But again, the same idea of what if you could use the web as a knowledge base, scoop that, you know, sort of ingest the web and run all these ever more sophisticated data mining algorithms on there to sort of catalog. And, you know, a simple example back then we found was creating bibliographies. So, for example, a faculty member would come along and say, you know, I'm really interested, you know, again, this is before Google Scholars, before all these different databases existed. Could you just scrape the web and find all the most heavily cited papers about a particular topic, maybe food insecurity in a certain area or some topic? And we could generate these bibliographies. We could look at the context in which they appeared in. Just simple, simple examples that you might say that's trivial, but yet that was transformative in certain domains.
So this moved from a pet project, for want of a better word, into something that you're doing and have been doing for quite a long time, full time. And take it back to, I know you're scraping all this data and you're getting all this data, and I really want to dig down into the languages and the fact that you've gone global and international with this. And yes, we live in a very English-centric world. But I suppose, why does it matter to gather? A lot of data is transient, right? Particularly news data. Why does it matter to capture this? Why does it matter to have the snapshot of this? How has it helped, or how does it help news agencies or journalists or research bodies, et cetera?
Yeah. So, you know, that's the thing. So you can imagine sort of this fire hose of news coming in. You might say, well, why bother? You know, what's the point? And so a great example of this actually is 10 p.m. Eastern Time, December 30th, 2019.
Right. Tell me.
This is a little bit ago. At 10 p.m. Eastern Time on December 30th, 2019, no one in the epidemiological community was watching Wuhan, China, looking for the next pandemic. But through the power of the fact that we're monitoring local news and local languages around the world, we saw this sudden anomalous spike of at the time period was described as a SARS-like viral pneumonia of unknown origin. And we saw that crystal clear in the data, kind of this big spike there. Again, the rest of the world wasn't talking about it. And even then, it wasn't, you know, no one was seeing it as a future pandemic. They were seeing it as local, as a local event. So using our data, a company up in Canada called Blue Dot Global, they monitor our data and they do actually biosurveillance. And their models then saw that in our data. And the following morning, then their human epidemiologist stepped in, looked at it and said, wow, this is actually really serious. They overlaid in transportation and other data to say, wow. So then they sent out the following day a worldwide alert, say, hey, you know, there's a really good possibility of a global pandemic coming. And so that's really the power of machines can watch the world and draw our eyes to things that we weren't even thinking about looking at. And that's kind of this to me, one of the really powerful aspects is the machine can watch and point us and say, hey, you should really take a look at this. The humans then can take a look at that and say, wow, this is huge, and then send that out. And also at the same time, every URL for online news coverage, every URL that we send that to the Internet Archive, where they preserve it inside the Wayback Machine. So we actually at the same time are essentially preserving, because online news is so ephemeral. And you think about why news? Well, news, you know, most of us, what we understand of the world around us is through news. And so the ability to preserve all of that so that future generations can look back and say, well, gee, in you know, back in December of 2019, what were people thinking about a future pandemic? What was kind of the discourse back then in the early days of the pandemic? It was only 2.5 years ago, but it's sort of this foggy memory already to be able to look back and say sequence by sequence, what actually happened around the world, to preserve that, but then to understand the future events that are occurring around the world.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, as you say, it was relatively recently. None of us knew what was going to happen. You know, we were pretty much oblivious in December 2019 as to what the world in March of 2020 was going to look like. So you mentioned earlier we live in a virtual data fire hose. There must be data from every corner of the earth. Literally, we have terabytes, if not petabytes of data being created all of the time. Are we at data overload? What can we do about that? How does, you know, the tools and the projects that you've been involved in help us deal with that?
See, this is to me one of the most fascinating aspects of the world we live in today. You know, we have just so much data every day, more and more data pouring out. But what we lack really are the tools. You know, we essentially live in a world where data is less and less the limiting factor. And more the limiting factor is how do we actually take that data and do something with it? And, you know, you think about annotation, think about video, for example. You know, in collaboration with the Internet Archive, we take a selection of television news every day and we run it through video AI that does OCR, you know, recognizes the on-screen text, objects and activities, and creates sort of this live catalog of these channels. And from that, what you end up with is essentially this enormous archive of JSON, hundreds of gigabytes, if not terabytes of JSON. So how do you go from a collection of terabytes of JSON to understandings of, you know, so in other words, how do we go from annotations to insights? And so here's a good example of this. In the early days of the pandemic, we asked, how is television news today different than it was pre-pandemic? You know, I'm seeing all this, you know, when I turn on the television, I see everyone presenting from home. So anecdotally, I kind of understand that something major's changed, but you know, what are the major changes? So we basically took that data and fed it to an anomaly detector. And the first thing that, you know, basically the first thing that popped out was bookcases. So, you know, it's kind of like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You know, like, what's the meaning of the uterus? 42. So, you know, the machine was like, well, what's different? Bookcases.
Bookcases. So, I love it.
And that's an interesting thing because we have these tools today that can do incredible annotation. Like a lot of video tools today, they'll annotate maybe 10 or 20,000 objects and activities. So it's sort of this fixed lexicon. So the machine could see that bookcases were everywhere, but the machine couldn't understand why that is. So that's where the human can then step in and say, well, in you know, at least in the US and Europe, bookcases are kind of the shorthand to expertise and knowledge and scholarliness. And it was interesting because some channels did not see bookcases. Some channels, bookcases did not rise. And so you could kind of, so that was an interesting thing. So again, the machine can tell us, and this is where, you know, you kind of say, well, we got this, you know, how do we go from, you know, we have this fire hose of video coming in. We use machines to annotate that. Now we then feed that to anomaly detection that can tell us bookcases are everywhere. So the human then can step in and say, well, that's because this is shorthand. And this is where it gets really interesting. You can say, wow, we know anecdotally that bookcases are the shorthand, but wow, we can actually now see quantitatively just literally these vertical kind of stories. Like everyone in America that rushed home at the start of the pandemic who was on television, they found the one bookcase in their house, or they bought a bunch of books and converted a bookcase. And that to me, it's, you know, again, like that powerful aspect, you know, and then, you know, you start asking, well, what else is useful about this? So one of the things that was really surprising to us was when we started doing video annotation, we thought that journalists were going to want to do visual search of the news, like that was going to be the dominant interface. But we found actually what was most useful to them was the OCR. Because what we found is it's really interesting when you think about, and this is going to be, I think, a big horizon, I think, for the analytics community. Right. So when we started doing this, we started off with television. How do we make television accessible to journalists? And so, you know, the first thing that we started with, well, we have these closed captioning, you know, all in the US, all television news has to be closed captioned. So we said, well, you know, people are used to doing a Google search. They know how to keyword search stuff. So what if we just wrap keyword search around closed captioning? So you can keyword search, get that. So that became something called the Television Explorer. And what we did that was a really innovative advance there is when you search traditional, whether it's any type of keyword search database, typically you just get search results. You don't get a timeline. Mm-hmm. But we realized immediately, and myself as a journalist as well, we realized that oftentimes the most important question is not what's being said right now, but is this more or less than the past? Like, how is it changing over time?
Okay, comparatively. Yes, yes.
Comparative. So we added in this timeline. So that became a huge, huge thing. But then you think, well, what's the next step beneath that? So how do we take this video and transform it? So what we found there was OCR text is a natural thing. It's still text. I can keyword search it. Mm-hmm. So it's easier. Now, it was still a lift because it was still kind of this idea of most people aren't used to it. We think of television news as I sit in front of a television and I watch it. Linear. You know, sort of the papyrus scrolling. We don't think of it as a non-linear format. So even the idea of keyword searching television was this huge leap for a lot of communities. And then the OCR search. And now kind of what we're really focusing on is how do we help with visual search? Like we have these incredible tools, but how do we teach people how to think visually? Like what are the questions I might ask? You know, one right now is with Ukraine. Visual search allows us to see that military imagery of Ukraine has really collapsed. Here in the United States, we're not seeing, when we talk about Ukraine, we're not seeing imagery of fighting. We're just seeing, you know, just oftentimes presenters in the United States. So again, these different levels, how do we search this material?
Okay, I think it must be fascinating to see the differences around the world as well as to, you know, if you're talking about news media and visual, there are certain events that are obviously global events. You mentioned Ukraine there, obviously, and COVID prior to that. How do you surface up local events? And also maybe, as you say, I suppose the COVID example in Wuhan, how does a local event become a global event as well too? What patterns can you recognize there in terms of news and how it's being reported?
You know, and this is where, again, the ability of data, you know, the ability to quantify a lot of things that we know qualitatively. So in journalism school, you know, you're taught, you know, that basically when a story breaks, like a sudden break, like an earthquake or a natural disaster, that you'll have sort of the 70, it'll surge into the news. There'll be 72 hours of coverage, and then it will rapidly fade away over the next week to 2 weeks. So that's something that you're just taught anecdotally. But in our data, we can actually see that crystal clear. But most importantly, we can actually measure that in real time. So we can take a story and we can actually, as a story breaks, we can actually measure it against that curve. And we can say, you know, this story is starting to deviate. We've seen that. We can actually see stories in the wild where all of a sudden they're following that. All of a sudden they deviate. And that's when we know this is no longer whatever the original story was. This is something else. This is an inorganic, you know, maybe it's been encapsulated into politics or something else. So we can see it kind of take on a different life. And the ability also to kind of see the, you know, how stories shift, but then this idea of sort of America to the rescue. Anything that happens around the world, suddenly you see this, hey, now that affects us, now don't worry, we'll solve it. And to be able to actually see those, to quantify those, that to me, it really comes back to this, you know, if you think about like the state of AI, because I mean, you think about the advances of AI today. I mean, it's incredible. You think about like, you know, GDAL is this fire hose of data. We have text, we have audio, we have video, we have imagery, all four modalities. 10 years ago, we didn't really have good tools to take that imagery and that video and do much. And even audio is real questionable. Okay. We have the tools now to annotate this stuff. So you can imagine data pours in. Now we can annotate that stuff, sort of that analytics side. And you think about today, AI, we really have AI annotation tools where they can take, say, a video and create live frame-by-frame annotations. And then we have sort of these prompt-based models, you know, these large language models, large sort of world models. But still, you know, these prompt-based models, you know, think about today, you know, rewind the clock, December of 2019. I have annotation data is annotating all this material. And within that is the early days of COVID. Within a prompt model, you have some of these newer tools that can ingest a lot of that material. But still, that would mean that in December 30th, 2019, someone's sitting at one of these prompts saying, is there a pandemic coming from this area of Wuhan in this, you know, coming next year? It's still very much human-centric. And I think one of the interesting kind of things that the future really holds is this idea of, can machines take on more and more of a role of, you know, you think about GDAL. I mean, we're 8.5 trillion data points and climbing very, very rapidly.
Wow.
And you think about that much data, no human every day, this fire hose of data coming in, no human can go through that. So really what we need is kind of this blending of machines being able to look through that and say, hey, kind of drawing your attention to things, but not just presence. And I think this is a real danger. A lot of the tools focus on anomalies in the positive direction, that all of a sudden something has burst into the scene. But oftentimes the most interesting anomalies are things that have faded quietly that we don't even notice. It's, you know, we're very good at detecting, hey, this is all of a sudden everywhere, but we're very bad at detecting, hey, something that was in the news everywhere is kind of faded away.
It's gone. And I suppose the, you know, as you said, machines are really good at crunching that data. AI and machine learning is getting better. We've got more powerful processors than we've ever had. We've more availability, we've more bandwidth, we've more cloud compute, but it is still ultimately some alert that goes back to a human to make a decision on that. And as you say, past events or the absence of news is crucial as well now.
Yes. And that's one of the things that we're finding with anomaly detectors. It's really crucial to look at both sides of that, you know, things that are bursting into the scenes, but also things that have kind of risen very slowly. We actually looked at sunflower oil shortages earlier this year with the invasion of Ukraine. You saw all of a sudden, you know, there was kind of this slow kind of rumbling of news coverage of, you know, this is going to potentially create real shortages in sunflower. And you saw a lot of governments around the world trying to prevent panic. So saying, don't worry, don't worry. But you saw, so if you look at like social media, you look at search data, you didn't see a surge in sunflower oil, but you saw it in news data. Okay. But it was a kind of a slow, steady rise. It wasn't that kind of sudden burst that we think about. And so within our data, we saw that crystal clear that, hey, this is a very, very big rise. So it was flagged in our data as an anomaly 2 weeks before all of a sudden it kind of burst into search data, burst into social media. And those are kind of, again, where the human machine interaction. You think about with the Internet Archive, we have something called the Visual Explorer. So this was started with the invasion of Ukraine. We suddenly have, we start monitoring Ukrainian, Belarusian, and Russian television news. And of course, you have speech recognition, so we can generate transcripts of that. But war scholars and journalists, they're oftentimes they're less interested in what was said and more interested in how it was portrayed. You know, if you think about this moment here in America, think about inflation. When I talk about inflation, what's the image on the screen? Is it food? Is it children that can't eat, you know, that are starving? Is it gas pumps? Is it prices at the store? There's so many different images that I could use to sort of visualize inflation. So what is the imagery that's being used? So that's oftentimes in war, that's what scholars care a lot about. And same thing with COVID. When COVID occurred, is it, you know, who's telling the COVID story? Is it doctors? Is it presidents at podiums? Is it, and people at the podium, if it's a president at a podium, are they standing there? Are they very confident? Are they standing sort of strong, confident, don't worry, we're solving this, or are they very sort of beaten down, like we don't know what we're going to do here? Those are things where machines, again, there's models that can do some of that, but that's where the machine can sort of say, here are the interesting, you know, here are sort of the segments to look at, and the human can kind of interpolate. So the Visual Explorer, we use machines to take this fire hose of video data. And I use this example because we think about annotations, we usually think AI, But annotations can be anything. So in the Visual Explorer, what we did is we took this broadcast. We want to make television news skimmable. So you think about, we think about television. We sit at a screen, we consume in a linear fashion. How do you make that skimmable? So I can look at a 1 hour broadcast in a few seconds. So we want to break it into a grid of thumbnails. And there was a lot of work about, you know, how do you do it? Is it every couple seconds? Do you use, you know, different tools? In the end of the, at the end, we basically split it every 4 seconds. We extract one frame. We make a thumbnail grid. We can just rapidly scroll through a broadcast. And that turned out to be truly transformative because now I can take a broadcast in a few seconds, see, oh, this is mostly war footage. This is mostly politicians. Mm-hmm. This is more this or that. So I can rapidly skim this. And when I look globally across the world, I can rapidly get a sense of just how does television news differ across the world? How is it the same? How does it differ? This totally unlocked our ability to look at television. And this isn't AI. You know, this is FFmpeg, you know, an off-the-shelf, simple, standard tool. And we just said, you know what? So it's that idea of taking this linear format of television, breaking into a thumbnail grid, then generating these images and basically creating an interface around that. So sometimes annotation to transform, to unlock massive archives might not be, you know, it might not require state of the air AI running of these massive GPU clusters. It could be something very simple. But again, it's that transformation, using machines to transform, in this case, petabytes and I think tens of petabytes of video to something that a human can consume very rapidly.
So you're essentially doing the, you know, in the developer world, we've lots of specs and scope documents, and usually somebody who's been nice to you as a developer, if you have to read their document, gives you a nice TLDR at the top, you know, too long, don't read, but if you need to read something, here's the summary. So you're doing a TLDR for news. I would love to be able to catch an hour's worth of news in a much shorter space of time. And we all have reduced attention spans. The internet is responsible for pretty much that. I know all of the conversation has been about news and media, and I know that GDEL doesn't really look at social, and a lot of people today would consider that their news comes from social feeds, but there's a reason behind that, right, Kalev, that you've explained to us before?
Yeah, I mean, social media, it's interesting. So, you know, social media, A, the data is not as accessible, you know, sort of within these walled gardens. Mm-hmm. But more importantly to us, so GDELT runs historically. So our total data set goes back 200 plus years. You know, for news, we go back to kind of the kind of late 60s, early 70s, which is kind of the rise of digital news. Although we are looking now, working on using OCR at historical archives to bring that. And we have actually, for books, brought that back over 200 years. So, you know, but social media, it captures a very tiny fraction of kind of our history. Because again, for us, we want to look at history to understand because something happens today. Is this important? Well, I need history to help me interpret that. But also social does not, it only captures, if I want to know how well you like your pumpkin spice latte in downtown Manhattan, social media is a wonderful place. I'll get so many reactions to that.
Or cats or dogs or exactly, any of that sort of
exactly.
Thing.
Exactly. But when I'm looking across the world, a lot less of that is reflected in social media. And, you know, people, it's very interesting because there's, again, we have all these ideas that end up not necessarily being true. There's kind of this, you know, common belief that social media beats the news. What we find is, you know, if I'm looking out my window and, you know, a tree blows down and I tweet that, yes, I beat the news there. But in major events, what we find is that actually news technically, like what happens is social might have a few little blips, but oftentimes not for a lot of things. It's the news that breaks it. And then the social kind of digests it and does its kind of this amplification of it. But the trick is with news. So in 2015, I looked at wildlife crime around the world. I want to understand elephant poaching and all these different things. And when I started that project, I was told, don't bother because the news media doesn't cover that. You know, it's just not something the news media talks about. But it turns out it was all over the world, but it was in local news. And I think that's the key that people don't oftentimes think about. And, you know, going back to your point of like the, you know, the sort of the summary of news, if you step back, I mean, GDEL really focuses on news. But if you step back, it's this broader question of, every organization today has so much data. You know, they have data from more and more sources. News is a great example. It was never designed for machine consumption. News is designed for humans to consume. So how does a machine understand data that was never designed for machines? And every organization has this issue of all this internal data. So how do we think about, you know, creativity? I mean, a good portion of GDEL, we think about the technical architectures of GDEL, but so much of it is really about the reimagining how we think about how we interact with data. You know, so much of GDEL is really this question of, like, we start with television. How could you make television accessible? How do you make it, so journalists and scholars and even and public policy officials, how do they interact with that? What are the very different needs? Because different interfaces, different ways of interacting with data. When we think about online news media, what are the different, think about it, it's got text, it's got imagery, all this kind of metadata, schema.org, all this different metadata that sits within that. You have layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. News changes. On the online world, news is rewritten. Really, even tier one news outlets today, they're blogs. They're not like printed news outlets anymore.
True. They're very much changed.
So you have all these different feeds. How do you combine all of that? If you think about these different lenses, how do we combine that? So, think about every organization today. They have all these different all these different data silos, there are all these different lenses to that organization's existence. Whether, if you're a consumer products company, you've got everything from your warehouses to your suppliers, all this different data feeding in. How do you unify that data? How do you think more creatively about, so oftentimes, if you think about like warehouses, a lot of the data focuses on, let me look at my inputs and outputs, what's going into the warehouse, what's going out, the speed, all this good stuff. But we don't think creatively about, well, what are some of the other questions that we can ask about this data? Oftentimes in companies, we get siloed into these very narrow classical questions. And I think one of the real interesting things is, how do we think creatively about data? How do we reimagine the very questions that we can ask with that data?
I think it's fascinating. And we started off talking about the fire hose of data that's around the world. And I actually have done a disservice to our listeners because I never explained what GDELT stood for. So do you want to tell us about that? Because it's fascinating. You've applied essentially some parameters to your data as well, too, in language and tone. But let's go into GDELT a little bit more, because as a project, it's public and available and for people to consume and to use that data. So what types of databases data do you have? How do we use it? But let's start with what GDELT stands for and ultimately what the L and T stand for in GDELT as well, too, because I think that's a fascinating breakdown of data.
Yes, it's fantastic. So the GDELT projects, GDELT stands for the Global Database of Events, Language, and Tone. And there's a fascinating trajectory to GDELT. So, GDELT really started about this idea of events. So can we take the news media and extract out codified events, protests, primarily, things that affect societal stability, because that's, specifically social scientists, typically sort of codified the news.
Sure. Geopolitical events, really, things that are going on in the world. Yes.
Exactly. And so, so that's where GDELT started. But then a colleague of mine, an old mentor, one of the things that he mentioned is he said, there's oftentimes really good ways of knowing where the tanks are in the streets. What we lack oftentimes as we try to understand the world around us is the narratives that underpin that. Because at the end of the day, he said, if a coup breaks out in some country or there's a famine, by that point, there's not a lot that we can do. There's some things, but kind of there's not a lot you can do. What you want to know is those earliest glimmers of instability or, for example, a famine, kind of these first glimmers of, hey, we're seeing more and more shortages across this. That's the point where you can really intervene to stop, to address that famine before it really becomes a big deal. So it's about understanding narratives that underpin that. So if you think about it, at the top level is things are physically manifest at this point. Mm-hmm. Before that, you have narratives. Now, before even that is emotions. Kind of maybe a sound, like take here in the US, kind of this idea of the economy, you have at the highest level, the government changes the interest rates or mortgage rates change, something changes. You have kind of the price of food changes. That's the physical part. Mm-hmm. Beneath that, before that are kind of the narratives. Are we hearing that interest rates are gonna go up? Are we hearing that there's gonna be food shortages? But then beneath that are this corner of this, as a society, are we optimistic about the future? Are we more gloomy? Are we anxious? Are we scared? These are all these fascinating kind of layers, like an onion, essentially, these different layers. Mm. So GDELT started with events, then it kind of moved into narratives, then it moved into emotions. Now, So that all focused on text. At the time period, again, imagery plays a huge role in the news, but the AI tools just didn't exist for it. So then the AI tools, there was kind of this moment in 2013, 2014, kind of 15, 16, where the image tools got better and better and better and better, and most importantly, globalized so they could deal with a globalized world. So then we were able to add imagery to that. So then, you know, speech recognition tools kind of reached a certain number of languages, a certain ability. So now we can add audio broadcast to that, you know, radio. Now video kind of reaches that point where it's tractable. You can actually ask real questions of it. So now we were able to add video to it. So GDAL's trajectory kind of follows the trajectory of AI annotations.
True.
But really kind of that pivoting, that, you know, you think about startups, we often, you know, people oftentimes talk about pivoting. So for us, it was less pivoting and more kind of expansion, that we realized that events are central to a lot of things, but then we kind of grow outwards. Now, an interesting development as well was early on, GDAL, it was strictly our annotation. So you would see the world was essentially our annotations, whether that was topics, emotions, et cetera. But more and more people, they have their own models. And really a driving factor of this was people started coming to us and saying, hey, you know, I've got this model that understands a certain type of protest. We've got an entire GPU cluster of 1,000+ GPUs. This model is immense. You know, how can we run that on data? So one of the things that we start looking at is, so GDAL oftentimes is used as an index. You use us to find news coverage of relevance that you didn't even know existed. And then you take that URL from us, crawl it and do something with. But then also n-gram. So word frequency histograms can kind of enable you to do, and this is the same thing with television. We're starting to look at n-grams for television. So GDAL is entirely open data. Really, so everything that we produce, we sort of ingest this fire hose. Absolutely every annotation, whether it's a video, JSON, whether it's an image, cataloging an OCR, whether it's textual, topics, emotions, et cetera, what we essentially produce is essentially this growing set of data sets that are all open data annotations. You can go to GDAL's website today. We have, and this is also, again, one of the interesting things, we have kind of three interface points to it. One is for some of our data sets, we have user-friendly APIs. You go to it, you can keyword search, like television, online news, you can keyword search it, get back those timelines, get back a set of results. So that's for people that maybe, especially maybe you're a journalist, you're on a deadline, you don't know how to download a petabyte of data and process it, nor do you have the resources.
Nor do you want to. Yeah.
Exactly. You just want to kind of get into it. Then we have the folks that they want the simple annotations. They want the high level, like just give me a list of the core topics that are mentioned in television this week or online news, because I just want to kind of look at it from a more topical standpoint. I can do data analysis, but I don't have a lot of compute power. Then you have the folks that want richer annotations. So they want to download a little bit more of the annotation data. Maybe they care about, you know, the MID codes that are like the actual specific ID codes that kind of disambiguate different objects and activities. Or maybe
tell me a little bit more about those ID codes, because they were fascinating, I know, when we were doing the hackathon and we'd participants in terms of categorization of events. And then on the other side of that too, you also had sentiment, a positive or negative sentiment attached to the data in GDAL. Can you explain a bit more about that?
Yeah, so this is one of the interesting things. So when we talk about sentiment, I think a couple of years ago when I last did the study, about 97% of sentiment work came out of computer science. We work instead primarily with the psychology community. So, you know, we talk about if you want to measure anxiousness, in computer science, you'll hire a bunch of Amazon Mechanical Turkers, code a bunch of things, come up with some labels. Psychologists will say, well, how do you assess anxiety? And so they'll start coming up with definitions and then they go from there. So we today monitor about between 2,000 and 4,000 emotions from every article. And we just run all of these off-the-shelf tools on top of it, to create all these different layers. So you can start really peering through the news in different lenses with different definitions. You know, if you're interested more in primal anxiety, you know, I'm fearful of the monster around the corner, or more anxiousness as in I'm kind of overwhelmed. We have those different definitions in the data. And that is, you know, really this... If you kind of step back, like that to me, like this idea of different access points, whether you have APIs, you have downloadable data, larger tools, this ability to make data set available to different communities in different ways that they need, whether they want small data or large data, but then this different idea of different lenses on, whether it's emotion, whether it's topics. And to go back to the ID codes, so this is, again, one of the things that we try to focus on is how do we give you different lenses onto the same question? So for example, for entities, we have two major entity data sets. One where we just do noun phrase extraction for content, and then we simply associate, if there's a Wikipedia entry for that entry, for that object, we associate the Wikipedia ID with it. But then we also run it through more sophisticated NLP APIs that look at things like the Freebase ID codes that go with that. I try to do more disambiguation. If this is a mention of Biden, it knows, well, that's Joe Biden. If I talk about the president of the United States, that's also right now the same code, and so on and so forth. So that's, again, I think one of the ideas of GDAL, if you think about GDAL, it's kind of two things. It's a production data set that looks at all these different lenses, but it's also a research platform to look at what would it look like? So one of the things that we're looking at right now is like speech recognition. What are the different ways that I can do speech? You know, how do I go from, say, a Russian news broadcast to translated, transcribed material that I, as a non-Russian speaker, can understand? What are the different tools that exist to do that? What are there different trade-offs there? You have the kind of the speed performance trade-off. There are tools that can produce incredible annotations, but require hours upon hours of the highest end GPU that's made today.
Understood.
So that's kind of something we look at oftentimes is, you know, what is kind of the horizon of these tools? What can they enable? So if you look at our blog, so the GDAL has a blog, just blog.gdalproject.org, and you see this stream of both, here's a new production data set that you can use today, completely open. You can build system, you know, build new tools on top of it. But then also, here's a new application. We're demoing this particular tool. What would it look like to run this tool across this material to kind of seed ideas and point people in different directions?
I love that. I think it's great. I know we spend time on the blog and the seeding of ideas were great there. I know during the hackathon that we ran in April and May, and we had 600 plus people registered, and they had a bit of a learning curve because it's such a large data set. But hey, we're MongoDB. We work with large data sets. That's what we like to do. And so my colleague, Joe Drumgool, and the other colleagues on the hackathon with me built a GDELT loader to get GDELT information or a snippet of GDELT information into MongoDB really easy. You could time band it. So you could say, I'm going to take 3 months of GDELT. Here are the dates that I'm interested in. You know, please go through that, import it, put it onto my cluster, and therefore I can work with it there. And that was great. We saw some really interesting projects. The ultimate winner of the hackathon built almost like a virtual newsroom where you played the role of the editor and you were deciding what topics were going to make it to the front page. And you use the GDELT data set to help you pick the most prevalent, most frequent topics globally to decide what your front page of news is going to be. And it was super nice. But particularly because we've lived through 2+ years of COVID, lots of projects were also using GDELT and using that sentiment that you mentioned, Colin, to pick out only good news. And GDELT as well is, as you know, the G is global and everything is geolocated. So they were picking out good news in their country. And these projects were great. We were seeing projects from all around the world. And they're saying, look, most news broadcast generally is, you know, isn't necessarily the positive news. You know, it's always the bad things that are happening around the world. So quite a number of projects use both the sentiment and the location to produce a news feed of good news. And I loved how they did that as well too. But the beauty for me was the variety of ways that you can interpret the news that you've been categorizing and cataloging all of this time. And you, as you say, you can go back 20+ years and even further as well too.
Yeah. And that to me is the greatest power of open data. You know, I've got tons of ideas, but you know, I just scratch the surface of what's possible. So this is what I love about open data. Every day, you know, again, because GDELT is open, I'm always the last to find out when, you know, what people do with it. And it's just every day I see just the most amazing things. There was a postdoc who did this amazing tool tracking how people are describing refugees around the world. You know, refugees are, and then looking at the phrases that appear after that. There was some great work on finding the happiness in the world. There's been, you know, incredible work on, you know, whether it's disease tracking or wildlife crime, just the huge breadth of them. And some of them, you know, powering, for example, the European Union's asylum agency, they actually did a paper, I think, in Nature Reports, where they actually used GDAL to power their risk forecasting system, actually look at refugee inflows. So it's incredible when you look every day at both, like, powering these production systems that change the world, and then all these amazing creative projects, you know, to create sort of these foundational systems that people use everywhere. And that to me is the real power of open data. The fact that I can create this data set and, you know, every day people use it to do the most amazing things. And that to me, just, it's just so amazing to just, you know, watch what people can do and to be able to sort of unlock people's creativity, point them to things that they never thought about, and just kind of like to teach people to reimagine the world. I mean, that's really what GDELT is it helps people think. It helps them to sort of We oftentimes get in these boxes, these silos, because we're constrained by the data we have, we're constrained by the tooling that we have. And, you know, Gito, it's so massive. And that actually oftentimes is a challenge because it spans everything.
It's quite daunting at first. I mean, I know when we first got started with it and the participants, they were going, you know, I can't work with this. This is massive. One of the concerns were, can they, you know, even a small subset, 3 months, 6 months of data, how big was that going to be? What size MongoDB cluster would be needed to house that data so that people could work locally on it? And it's fascinating that I think as technology, as you said earlier, continues to improve and things continue to grow. Yes, storage is less of an issue these days. We think of the cloud as the cloud, but there are actual disks sitting in actual machines still storing this data. But I think compute is obviously going to be one of the things that is going to become, you know, superbly advanced in terms of that machine learning and AI that you speak about. What's next for GDELT? Where, you know, is it more of the machine learning AI, or is there some other avenues that, you know, you're saying you're constrained with at the moment that you'd love to get in there, but you don't have access to the data or can't crunch it or can't infer kind of analysis out of it just yet?
Yeah, and you know, and to your point, by the way, of kind of the compute, I will say when GDELT, you know, a decade ago when GDELT first launched, what was amazing about it was it would take me, I could run a query. If I want to know, are events increasing or decreasing in a country, that would take me almost a day running on my local works. You know, I had a nice little Dell server sitting in my house. And, you know, it would take a day to run a basic query just because of the hardware, the software that existed at the time period. Mm. And, you know, as the tooling got to the point where we could search it real time, that fundamentally changes it. And people don't oftentimes appreciate that when I know, if I'm going to run a query and I know it's going to take me a couple of hours, I fundamentally self-limit the questions I'm going to ask. I say, you know, this is a hugely important question, but I know that there's probably not going to be a useful result. So I'm not going to bother running it because I can't afford to spend hours and hours waiting for it. When it becomes real time, suddenly we move to that what if. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, when I start saying, you know, I wonder, that's really when everything changes. And that's really what the power of tooling today, tools like Mongo are really, you know, changing that. They're fundamentally changing our ability to interact with data. And you know, in terms of the future, the biggest thing to me is at the end of the day, we are this fire hose of data coming in from across the world. What we want to get to is at the end of the day, you know, my holy grail is a machine that can look through the news like a sort of a friendly HAL 9000, not the bad HAL 9000.
Not the one that's going to push you through the bay door and kill you.
Exactly. You know, a machine that can literally read through all that material and tell me what's important about the world, both what it knows that I need to know, but then also the things that maybe I don't even know that I need to know or that I might find interesting. You know, and machines that can essentially read the news, take action about that, that can actually truly understand the news. So, you know, that involves multimodal things that can look across television, radio, text, and imagery, systems that can process more and more languages. You know, that's been a huge focus of us. You know, we monitor 150 today. We're pushing past 400 shortly. So that ability to kind of look ever more across the world, but machines that can do more creative annotations, more sophisticated analyses. You know, we would love in television. So we produce every 4 seconds, basically a screen capture. We actually make that accessible to now allow non-consumptive visual analysis over television. You know, that's, I think, 1.9 billion images now and climbing rapidly.
Oh, wow.
And so you think about that, like, what could you do with that? I mean, there's so many possibilities. Well, I would love to be able to say, for example, like here's a particular story. Find other stories like this, and maybe a certain framing of a story. Like maybe I see a broadcast that's about inflation. Like a good example of this. So you know, there was a report yesterday. All these economists have said, hey, you know, we think there's a high chance of a recession coming in. Now, I remember some of those names I recognized as a year ago saying there's zero possibility of inflation. But, you know, when you kind of search, like, yeah, I can search a name by name by name by name, I would love a machine where I can say, find this story, but kind of trace this story where they said it wouldn't happen, like a tool that could do that. So again, some of these are holy grail questions, but some of these we can approximate using tools that already exist today. So it's really about higher and higher levels of reasoning on top of material. And this is what companies want too. You know, at the end of the day, companies, they have this fire hose of data. They run all these annotation tools, but companies don't want petabytes of JSON data. They don't want prompt-based models. What companies want are that kind of that live, either a machine that can point them to things that they care about, but then on top of that, this human-machine interaction. And I think that's where the field's advancing so fast. I mean, it's stunning to me every day, all the papers that come out. But, and again, just both the annotations, but then the tools that can harness this type of data. You think about, you know, MongoDB, this ability where you can put whole fractions of GDAL into there and be able to rapidly, interactively query. Like the fact that this is no longer something where I'm looking at a year of expenditures and massive teams. The power today where I sitting at home can log into, you know, spin up some machines, install that software, load huge amounts of data into it, and just run with it. That is just so fundamentally transformative to the types of questions that can be asked. It, to me, I think that's the future is really as compute continues to make the impossible possible, the intractable tractable. As more and more data comes online, as we have the compute that makes the tractable, the formerly intractable tractable, as we have AI tools that can do richer and richer annotations over all this material, and as we get tools that can reason over more and more of that anomaly at larger and larger scales, I think that really the future is so, there's so much possibility there. You know, and think about even something as simple as fact-checking. You know, if I'm a fat, you know, we did a simple demo using embeddings. So we took television news, we went sentence by sentence in the closed captioning, built a sentence level embedding over that. And then we did a demo. We took a fact check off of factcheck.org, you know, microchips and vaccines. We just took that and we said, scan television news for that. And, you know, you could keyword search microchips, vaccines. You got some stuff, but this embeddings found all that stuff about nanochips in the mind control liquid, you know, all this, all those different ways of framing it. And it was able to find all of that. That's something that we never even, it wasn't even a possibility. It wasn't even something over the horizon. It was a total impossibility. And today, again, thinking creatively about how can we use these tools, that to me, like, what could you do with that? How could we think about debates? One of the things I'm very interested in is, in an increasingly polarized world, how can we kind of show people, like, sort of a, I did a map a couple of years ago about the global media system and how often news outlets link to each other. So I call it a map of the media. You could take, here are the media outlets that I consume the most. Here's where I exist in the universe of media. Now, again, some people might say, great. Some people might say, hey, wow, I'm missing a whole side of this world over here. So again, to
of course, there's a natural bias, right? Depending on where you're receiving your media from and consuming your media from. And it really just boils down to, you know, your view of the world versus other parts of the world's view of the world as well.
Give people visibility to help them see where they exist in the world. So it's really this idea of the compute, the AI annotations and the reasoning systems, but then interfaces. I mean, even the Visual Explorer, I mean, we're just taking an MPEG file, convert it to images. There's nothing, you know, it's FFmpeg with some wrappers around it, but that was so transformative. I mean, that tool, that capability existed for a very long time. It was just, A, the compute now is to the point where we can do this tractably at this scale. But again, at the end of the day, that was an idea. It took the, I wonder, and the fact that the tooling exists to be able to suddenly roll that out at scale. And then I think the Visual Explorer is a great example of that's, you know, that's an open source tool. It's a couple of wrappers around an open source tool. You could have done this. There was no, it's not like AI where the tool just didn't exist. This all existed.
Yes.
It was this thought, this idea to suddenly bring into fruition. And that to me really, it really talks to the fact that there's so many possibilities that exist right now that just require someone to say, you know, I wonder. And to create it.
That's an amazing thought. Yeah. And a great way to nearly get us towards the end of the show as well. This, you know, the data's there, the tools are there, the power and the compute is mostly there and growing all the time. So it is purely that question. I wonder what I can do with this and how do I put it to good use and how do I extract understanding from this? So for GDelt as a whole, like, I'm a big fan. I love what you're building. I love what it is. How do I contribute to the community? How do people get involved in the project? Is it by building their own projects and showcasing them on your blog and things like that?
Yes, so that's a great question. So you know, again, interfaces, we love when people build interfaces, whether, you know, like what you guys did, a loader into MongoDB, people built R modules and Python modules, all these different kind of connectors to different tools. And those are fantastic. That, because again, it lowers the burden, because GDAL is this enormous data set. When someone sits down like, wow, I want to use this in my project, and they stare at, wow, I'm looking at all this data, like how do I actually, and especially every
program. It can be quite daunting at the start when you realize the sheer extent of it. Where do you even go?
Exactly. And then what I also love is, again, the AI, the analytics world, if you think about it, the analytics world is changing so rapidly. There's no way any single person. So, you know, if you're someone who specializes maybe in visual understanding of imagery, you know, we've got so much data. We'd love to see you go with that. If you specialize maybe in new forms of entity or more forms of whatever your specialty is, take GDAL, do interesting, creative things, whether that's answering a real, so that could be answering a real world question. Like, I wonder how COVID television is changing. That could be, we see a lot of people doing interesting scaling work. So we have these embeddings. We've got, I think, over almost a billion embeddings now. You know, that's an unsolved research question. How can I do efficient stuff? So that could be to unlock new possibilities. That could be new types of annotation tools, or it could simply be more new interfaces. Because one of the things that GDAL lacks right now, we have data, but not interfaces. How can you take this fire hose and build an interface around it, a user interface, whether that's a prompt, whether that's a visualization, whether that's a human interface, whether that's a totally automated tool. Those are the type of things that I would love. And again, because GDAL's all open, you can go today, you can download our data, you can do all kinds of things. And if you have something that's interesting, send it to us. We love to feature these things on our blog.
Excellent, excellent. And so we will put the links in the show notes, both to GDAL Project, which is gdalproject.org, also to the hackathon. You can see some examples of what was built during the MongoDB hackathon with that, and other links to really, really interesting projects. I think we've got enough content here for probably getting you back in another number of months as well, too. I think you're on the pulse of everything that's happening. I love the analogy of, you know, what was the common theme of COVID? It was bookcases. I certainly think we can all relate to that. I need to get a bookcase behind me here instead of a bunch of old tech hardware, obviously. But this has been super fascinating. Anything to sign off to our listeners on, Kalev? Anything else that you didn't get through in our chat today?
No, I think really at the end of the day, I mean, GDAL, again, it's the global database of events, language, and tone, because it's this idea of looking across the world. If you think about it, the highest level vision isn't even news. It's really about this idea of how do we codify the planet, the events, the narratives, our global dreams and fears. How do you codify that in a way that allows us to better understand the world around us? Essentially, to look at the global heartbeat, to understand ourselves as a world, to look through the eyes of others. I mean, these are these grand visions of what would the world look like if I could see it through the eyes of everyone around me, of people on the other side of the world. Like, those are those grand challenge questions that we now have the data, the compute, the analytic tools to actually ask those questions. And so to me, this is the most exciting. I mean, it's such an exciting time to be alive right now, because, I mean, we're really at that cusp where there's so much movement across all of these fields. And, you know, GDAL is open data for a reason, to allow people to build these incredible things, to really ask these incredible questions, to sort of seed creativity. I mean, GDAL really makes it possible for you to say, you know, I wonder. And to just go from there, to take that data and do something amazing with it. And so really, that's what I would love to call on people to do, is just, you know, to be inspired, to ask those questions. And when you find fun things, send them to us. We would love to talk more about them.
That's absolutely fascinating. And this has been a superb conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed it and learned a lot, as usual, any of my conversations with you. So for those listeners, gdeltproject.org is where you go. And, you know, we're really looking forward to seeing how you answer that I wonder question that Kalev is proposing to you all. Kalev, it's been superb to have you on the MongoDB podcast with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
A simply fascinating conversation with Kalev. A wealth of information to take in there. Dare I say it? Nearly too much. It probably deserves a re-listen. But we will certainly have to get him back as a future guest.
If this has piqued your interest, I highly recommend to check out the show notes for links to gdelproject.org and also to the MongoDB hackathon that was conducted on the MongoDB forums. You can check out all of the projects and submissions there too. Have you a story of interest to our listeners? We are always looking for guests on the MongoDB podcast, people with stories to tell in the world of software development and data. So if you feel you can contribute, do email us at podcast@mongodb.com and we'd love to hear from you. Do you know that during November and December, we have .local events and MongoDB days in many cities globally? If interested, you can find out more at mongodb.com/events and see if there's an event near you. And the best part, all of the events are free to attend. Thank you so much again for listening. We really do appreciate it. If you do enjoy the episodes, please leave us a rating and even a review on whatever podcast platform you use. It really helps us. So for me, Shane McAllister, and the rest of the podcast team, until next time, do take care. And thanks for listening.
Attention MongoDB enthusiasts. We've got some exciting news for you. On June 22nd, 2023, MongoDB is bringing its world-renowned .local conference to New York City. This is an event you won't want to miss. At MongoDB.local New York City, you'll have the opportunity to learn about the latest updates and tools to build and deploy mission-critical applications at scale. Whether you're a seasoned developer or just getting started with MongoDB, there's something for everyone at this action-packed event. Get ready to experience an announcement-filled keynote, dive into technical sessions on application development, data modeling, security, and much more. Plus, you'll have the chance to network with like-minded professionals and MongoDB experts. Don't miss this incredible opportunity to boost your MongoDB knowledge and skills. Save the date, June 22nd, 2023, in the heart of the Big Apple, New York City. For more information and to secure your spot, head on over to mdb.link/2023 or check out the show notes of this episode. Be sure to use the code PODCAST50 for a 50% discount on your tickets. See you there.